This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. Following a fourth trip this year to Pyongyang, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Sunday he and leader Kim Jong-un agreed to arrange soon a second leadership summit between the North Korean leader and President Donald Trump. They also discussed potential U.S. monitoring of Pyongyang's steps toward denuclearization. The North Korean leader described the talks as productive and wonderful. The two sides are to arrange working-level negotiations for the second summit. Atlantic Council senior fellow Robert Manning described the progress toward denuclearization so far as glacial, with only vague commitments since the first summit in June.
I don't see how you get from the vague promises of the Trump-Kim summit to actual denuclearization. That's going to require, you know, rolling up your sleeves and hard negotiating give and take between North Korean and U.S. senior negotiators.
Manning said the U.S. must press for a full accounting of the North's arsenal.
The first step has to be North Korea declaring its inventory of nuclear material and facilities to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Because if we don't know what they have, how can we possibly know we've denuclearized them? That should be an obvious question, and I don't know why no one is asking it.
The North Korean leader said he believed dialogue with the U.S. would continue to develop favorably based on what he called the deep confidence between the two leaders. 75-year-old Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, seeking re-election next February, will face a formidable challenge from 71-year-old former Vice President Atiku Abubakar of the main opposition People's Democratic Party. He is a Muslim from the north. Security and the economy expected to dominate the issues. Prisoners at a jail in the South Sudanese capital Juba were able to disarm guards and seize control of the detention center Sunday. A leader of the uprising said he had been detained since April without charge or hope of a fair trial. This is VOA News. Brazilian rightist lawmaker Jair Bolsonaro came in first in the country's presidential election, but fell short of the 50% threshold, setting up an October 28 runoff with leftist former Sao Paulo mayor Fernando Haddad. Bolsonaro took nearly 47% of the vote to Haddad's 28%. Georgia State University political science professor Jennifer McCoy believes she understands Mr. Bolsonaro's success.
Given the depth of the crisis in Brazil that, you know, has arisen from huge, widespread political corruption that has alienated the voters tremendously, and an economic crisis, a slowdown in the economy, and unemployment rising, you know, that people have just rejected the political establishment.
Bolsonaro has vowed to crack down on crime and corruption. Syria's President Assad Sunday said the Russia-Turkey deal to create a demilitarized zone in rebel-held Idlib province is only temporary. He also insisted Idlib and other Syrian territory under rebel control will return to the Syrian state. Turkish President Erdogan said Sunday he's following the case of missing Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi closely after Turkish officials said they believe he had been killed inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Mr. Erdogan said he expects the outcome will be positive. Khashoggi, a frequent critic of Saudi policy, left his country last year fearing retribution. Last week he sought documents at the consulate for his forthcoming marriage and has not been seen since. The Israeli army is searching for a Palestinian who shot dead two Israelis and wounded another at a West Bank settlement industrial zone Sunday. Meanwhile, the wife of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made a court appearance Sunday at a fraud trial in which she is alleged to have misused more than $100,000 in state funds. Sarah Netanyahu has denied any wrongdoing. Democratic U.S. Senator Chris Coons Sunday said it's time to move on from the bitterly partisan battle over the confirmation of President Donald Trump's latest Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh.
Frankly, the challenge I'm focused on is looking forward at how it is we can heal the Senate after this bitter and divisive and very partisan week, and how we work to restore or strengthen some of the legitimacy of the Supreme Court.
Kavanaugh emphatically denied allegations of sexual misconduct made decades ago that surfaced during his confirmation hearing. 20 people were killed Sunday when a limousine crashed into another vehicle and pedestrians in a parking lot in rural New York State in what's being called the deadliest U.S. transport crash in the last decade. All 18 people inside the limousine died. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, October 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Vote counting has begun in Sunday's Cameroon presidential election, marred by violence in the English-speaking regions.
It's an important thing for me to vote as a citizen of this country so that things should go normally and let us have peace, justice, and development.
A voter in the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé, Nigeria's main opposition PDP party, has chosen former Vice President Atiku Abubakar as his standard bearer for the 2019 presidential election. Is there a new political freedom in Rwanda following Friday's provisional release of Diane Rwigara? And South Sudan's first vice president tells officials in Washington why the latest peace deal will work.
People learn through experiences, and we have a wealth of experiences. We know where we were wrong as leaders to the country. This time we are very serious for this peace to work.
Taban Dengai is South Sudan's first vice president. The South Sudan government says a hostage crisis Sunday in Juba has been resolved peacefully. And this morning we'll talk with a Kenyan TV anchor who is also a mortician. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Vote counting has begun in Sunday's Cameroon presidential election that was marred by violence in the country's English-speaking regions. There are eight candidates, including the country's 86-year-old President Paul Biya, who has ruled Cameroon for 36 years. He is widely expected to be re-elected. As Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, fighting between armed separatists and the military has killed at least six people in the English-speaking regions.
Among the voters in Yaoundé, choosing Cameroon's leader for the next 7 years is 50-year-old driver Christian Gabba, who says incumbent President Paul Biya convinced him he will solve the problems that have rocked the English-speaking regions of the country for more than 2 years.
It's an important thing for me to vote as a citizen of this country so that things should go normally and let us have peace, justice, and development.
Every voter was not as lucky. Student Eric Agbo fled the English-speaking southwestern town of Boya after fighting between government troops and armed separatists who vowed the election would not take place. He is living in Yaoundé with a friend, but says he came out to vote for an opposition candidate and was told he could only vote in Boya, where he registered.
Joshua Osei has promised equal opportunities and enhancing development to in the country, so I think he's the best candidate I can vote for. It's difficult for me to go to Southwest now, given that there's social unrest.
Election security in the English-speaking regions was tightened after violent battles in several towns and villages. The governor of the Southwest region, Bernard Okala Bilai, says many terrorists were killed and several buildings and residences were set ablaze.
Some terrorists wanted to disturb, but the defense forces reacted promptly.
The government said at least two armed men were killed by the military in the English-speaking northwestern town of Bamenda. More than 200,000 people have been displaced because of violence in the English-speaking regions, with many towns deserted. Election observers, including the African Union, have said they will not work in the southwest or northwest because of the crisis. But after voting, President Biya said he was happy peace was returning to troubled spots.
D'abord, un sentiment de satisfaction du devoir accompli.
He says he has performed his civic duty and is particularly satisfied the election is taking place in calm and serenity without fighting. He says voting for president should be an important act for all citizens and his wish is for calm when results are announced. He says he sees the Cameroonian people continue to give him their confidence. Main opposition Social Democratic Front Party candidate Joshua Osei called for transparency in vote counting. Biya is expected to be re-elected as the fractured opposition has been unable to rally behind a strong challenger. Cameroon law says results are to be proclaimed within 15 days of the poll. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Former Nigerian Vice President Atiku Abubakar was chosen Sunday as the standard bearer of the main opposition People's Democratic Party, the PDP, to take on President Muhammadu Buhari in the February 2019 presidential election. Speaking Sunday, Abubakar said the PDP would be different from the Buhari government if it can provide solutions for the problems for which it was criticized the government. Victor Barima De Wifa, the Secretary General of the Ogoni PDP in the diaspora. He says the Ogoni people support Atiku Abubakar because as vice president, he had an idea that if he had the chance to implement, would have returned the region's resources to the people.
Atiku is a man that I would have loved to have been the Nigerian president before now, because him being the vice president, he had a vision for the Niger Delta, which, if he was given an opportunity then, would have been able to help to change a whole lot within the Niger Delta and Nigerian region. Buhari doesn't have that vision right now. He introduced the Niger Delta ministry, and I think in person of Atiku, he will be able to use his position as the president of Nigeria to actualize the reasons why the Niger Delta ministry was formed, which was to be able to bring the militants out of the creek, be able to use the resources to build a place. Atiku, being rich, knows the ideals of economic policies that could help Nigeria. So we in the diaspora from the Ogoni Axis that have been tortured and have suffered a lot from Nigeria knows the value of economic reform, restructuring, and development, which Atiku has that together. And that's why we as Ogoni PDP in diaspora is supporting Atiku for presidency of to run Nigeria.
Well, you mentioned the former vice president's support for regional autonomy, meaning places like the Ogoni region. But doesn't that divide Nigeria further?
No, it does not divide Nigeria further. All what that says is that you give the Ogoni people the opportunity to be able to rule themselves, work in their environment, be able to dictate or decide and bring what they produce to the federal government, and not the federal government now giving to them to be shared to them again. Because when the federal government share out to them, many other states don't even produce. And yet they are benefiting more. He's from the central north of Nigeria. He's a Muslim. I am a Christian by birth. And if I'm supporting him, that means there is something good in him that cuts across the board.
I was going to ask that question because of this Christian south versus Muslim north. I thought maybe that creates more polarization of Nigeria.
I believe he doesn't foster that kind of division because he introduced the Niger Delta Ministry, where the Delta youth of the South-South could be developed. The same money that is being took away from the South-South is being used to develop the North. So if he fostered that kind of belief, the North against the South, he won't have that kind of idea, which former President Yar'Adua promoted, which Yar'Adua actually encouraged before he passed away.
Victor Barima De Wifa is Secretary General of the Ogoni PDP in the diaspora. He was speaking with me from the U.S. city of St. Louis in Missouri. South Sudan's first vice president, Taban Deng Gai, says his trip to the United States was successful. Gai says a lot of Americans are skeptical about South Sudan's September 12 peace agreement, but he says the South Sudanese leaders have accepted to work together for the stability of their country. Gai says his meetings with influential Americans in Washington will change the perception of Americans towards South Sudan.
There's a lot of skepticism. Not many people believe that this peace will work, because as you know, I don't know, this is peace number what that we have signed in the Republic of South Sudan. So there's a lot of doubt, and our work is to allay those fears. We have given the reason why we think this peace will work this time. We say the attitude of the leaders have to change. People learn through experiences, and we have a wealth of experiences. We know where we were wrong as leaders to the country. This time we're very serious for this peace to work. Second is that this peace has many stakeholders. It is a very accommodative peace. It brought on board many swing groups, many political parties, civil societies, women group, youth. So many people are involved in the process of the implementation of this peace.
And people have been saying that it's the same actors. You're saying many people are involved and, it's now all inclusive. But these are the same people who disagreed in 2015 or 2016. So what is new this time?
Yes, you are correct to say that these are the same actors, and these are the current leadership of the country. You don't have how do you replace them? Because these are the people who are leading the government, people who are in opposition, they have imposed themselves. You have no mechanism of replacing them now. The new thing is that they have accepted to work together. The government have accepted to receive back Riek Machar as first vice president. We are going to have five vice presidents, six people in the presidency, from president to the vice president, which are five, including Riek Machar. So these leaders, they disagree, and they have accepted to work together to forgive themselves, to open a new page.
Taban Dengai is South Sudan's first vice president. He spoke with John Tanza of View South Sudan in Focus program over the weekend in Arlington, Virginia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, October 8th. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. The South Sudan government says a hostage crisis that broke out early Sunday in the capital, Juba, has been resolved peacefully. About 200 prisoners in the country's notorious Blue House prison broke into a store in the prison where weapons are kept and held two unarmed prison guards hostage. The prisoners told VOA they did not want violence but wanted their voice heard. Atain Wakatain is spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir.
This is a crisis that was quickly resolved, and all the prisoners have returned to their normal position.
What happened?
A prisoner, one of the national security officers, who is a captain by the rank, called Cardino Wall, he's actually locked up for administrative reasons, because he's an officer and has committed a crime that made him to be locked up. So at 1 o'clock in the morning, he led the guard on the premises that he was sick. So the guard came in to help him. In the state of being helped, he snatched with some other prisoners. He snatched the gun from the guard. They have used that gun to also capture other guns from the other guards who were actually sleeping. And therefore, those who were sleeping were all, you know, just got themselves being ordered to give up their guns or being shot.
One account said that as many as 400 prisoners were there in that prison. If that is the case, you are holding prisoners. Is that correct? Political prisoners also?
That's a complete lie. Even the facility itself is very small. It cannot even carry, practically cannot even carry more than 200 or 150. It cannot take it. The facility is very small, and this is, it has been used, this place as a transit point for the criminals who are actually answering cases of a crime they committed. And most of them are soldiers who do not actually necessarily fall within the category of what you call the political detainee.
I asked the question about the political prisoners because one claim, at least what I've read, is that these prisoners carry out what they did because they were demanding the release of political prisoners. Is that the case?
No, that's not the case completely. You know, even in America, James, if in a maximum prison, if a criminal of a terrorist nature decided to get the opportunity and seize a gun of the guard and try to demand their release, I don't think the American authorities will actually cooperate with such criminals. Even now, they have even increased their crime by trying to escape by using full force of arms. Miraculously, the bloodshed was avoided, but the crime has been committed. Even more crime has been committed by the prisoners who have actually participated in the process of trying to escape by force. So no country in the world that would accept this. You would not call it political. This is purely criminal and will be dealt with by the law. South Sudan has no political prisoners. The political prisoners that qualify to be political prisoners have been all released. Who have remained are this type, are the type of these who wanted to force their way out, you know, without due process of the law.
Atain Wakatain, spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir, was speaking with me from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Some opposition political activists say a court decision Friday to release on bail opposition activist Diane and her mother, Adeline Rwigara, could be the beginning of a free political space in Rwanda.
Songs and tears turned the courtroom into church just after Judge Claire Bukuba ordered the immediate release on a bail of Diane Rwigara and her mother. Judge Bukuba's decision was a rejection of the prosecution's claim that accused should not be released because they were a risk to national security and could escape justice or recommit their crimes on a greater level. But citing Articles 105 and 121 of Rwanda's Penal Code, the judge said the accused have the right of being provisionally released. However, the High Court banned Diane and her mother from leaving the capital, Kigali, without authorization of the public prosecution. For Diane's sister, Anne Rwigara, this was good news.
There is so much more to come. This is not ultimate justice. This is only the beginning of justice. We are just praising God and hoping for a positive outcome as we move forward. We are extremely happy about the court's decision. Happiness mixed with different kind of emotions because it was not necessary. So you do not get incarcerated for your opinions or your ambitions. We should be free to express and think what we want.
Victoire Ingabire, a political activist recently released on the presidential mercy, says the court's decision marks the beginning of free political space in Rwanda.
I am happy with this decision because it is happening. After that, a few weeks, I was released. It is a good sign that we begin really to work the long way about opening up of a political space in our country.
Diane's lawyer, Hur Pierre Celeste, assures that apart from being happy to release his client on a bail, lightens his way in defending for not met win.
The conditions are not complicated because those conditions are in our law. Now I can see how the case will be in merit. When we enter in merit of this case, we know how what we can get after the trial. Yes, and we know how we can prepare now the trial for the merit. And it is this decision is very, very helpful for us.
Diane and her mother are expected to return to court a month from today, November 7th, on charges of forgery and inciting insurrection. She faces up to 15 years in prison on the insurrection charge. Her mother also faces charges of using discrimination and sectarian practices. Both Diane and her mother say the charges against them are politically motivated. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali.
He's an anchor with Kenya's K24 television station, but Eric Njoka is also a mortician. He explains how it all came about.
It's my dad who introduced me to mortuary business, so to speak, and I joined his own build mortuary when I had completed my high school. So he sort of introduced me to that business so that I could carry the family's mantle or support the family business. So it was a family business, so to begin with.
So for the sake of our listeners, what do you as a mortician do?
Okay, what we do as morticians is we receive dead bodies and then we sort of clean them up and prepare them for burial. And again, that's basically the business of a mortician. He or she is mandated to ensure that once the body has been registered, once the body has been taken in, it is cleaned, it is disinfected, so to speak, it is embalmed. And embalming is a process where a liquid called formalin is injected into the corpses, and then it is used to preserve the body, so to speak. So fast forward, then you prepare the body for burial.
I think most Kenyans, they see you in the street, they can recognize you as that television reporter or that television anchor. Do they know that you are a mortician?
Now they know. I think when the news broke last week, I was a little bit skeptical to tell my story because I had that fear that people would be afraid of me, they would avoid me, they would not come close to me, they would not talk to me. But I think I gained that courage from my family, my siblings. So eventually I just had to narrate my story. And when the story broke last week, now Kenyans know that my side hustle, as they're calling it, is to be a mortician, of which I appreciate because right now they know that a person who sits on screen or a person who's an anchor or a reporter, there's something else he can do, and that something else is definitely extraordinary. It is a taboo here that mortuaries are feared, mortuary attendants are, they're feared, they're disrespected, so to speak, and they're not appreciated in the society. So I had to bring that to light and tell people that these are humans. They're humans who work in a mortuary, and they appreciate the work that they do.
For most journalists out there, there are so many ways people can earn their living, and I think your story is very unique, and we just want to say thank you very much again, and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you very much for this interview.
Eric Njoka is a Kenyan television anchor who is also a mortician. He spoke with me from Nairobi. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin with athletics, where Kenya's marathoner Bridget Kosgei clocked the third fastest time in history of 2 hours, 18 minutes, 35 seconds to win the Chicago Marathon title in windy and wet conditions on Sunday. Kosgei separated from the pack of 20 miles and never looked back on roads to victory. Ethiopia's Rosie Dereje finished second in 2 hours, 21 minutes, 18 seconds, followed by fellow Ethiopian Shure Demisa in 2 hours, 22 minutes, 15 seconds. In the men's category, Great Britain's Mo Farah claimed his maiden marathon win in only his third race. Staying with marathon news, after falling short of victory each of the last three editions of the Midtronic Twin Cities Marathon, Elisha Barno won Sunday's race in 2 hours, 11 minutes, 58 seconds. The four-time Grandmas Marathon champion took the lead at mile 25 to edge compatriot Boniface Kongin, who ran in 2 hours, 12 minutes, 12 seconds. Ethiopia's Sinke Biladilin won the women's division of the race in her first attempt, clocking 2 hours, 33 minutes, 4 seconds. And now to football news. Harambe Stars coach Sebastian Mini, alongside 5 national team players, traveled to Ethiopia ahead of Wednesday's 2019 African Cup of Nations qualifier, which will be played at the 60,000-seater Bahir Dar Stadium in Bahir Dar. The rest of the squad, including foreign-based players, are expected in Addis Ababa on Monday afternoon before the entire contingent proceeds to the northern city of Bahir Dar. Coach Mini, who has threatened to quit his job if the government does not remit all his dues by October 15, says that he is targeting a win in the away fixture so as to lessen the pressure on the team during the return match scheduled for Sunday next week in Nairobi.
We'll try our best, and I hope I will not have injuries during the weekend. And after, we will see. We'll try to compete well and to be in 1 week, maybe leader on this group.
Ghana will begin their preparations for the upcoming AFCON qualifiers encounters against Sierra Leone on Monday. The Black Stars are scheduled to face the Leone Stars in 2 2019 African Cup of Nations qualification Group F matches later this month. The team will start training under Ghana head coach Kwesi Appiah in Kumasi on Monday ahead of the two encounters. And finally, in rugby news, South Africa national rugby coach Resi Erasmo believes his team, the Springbok, can win the 2019 Rugby World Cup in Japan after the dramatic 32-30 loss to New Zealand in Pretoria on Saturday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
That's it for this Monday, October 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Bote in Washington.
Hello, I'm Lino Mudu, host of Health Chat. Next week on Health Chat, we'll discuss the burden of poor quality health systems worldwide and what can be done about it. Our guest is Dr. Margaret Crook of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.